practices and industry standards. For example, we've worked with the Consumer Technology Association on developing standards for trustworthiness and recommendations for bias management. And we're also leading a broad-based multi-stakeholder effort to modernize and enhance demographic data content standards. We all know that many overlapping and incomplete standards exist today. By seeking to ensure that standards are culturally sensitive, sufficiently granular, and aligned across stakeholders, we can enable the collection of secure, accurate, complete, comparable, actionable, and interoperable data. In turn, access to these data will support better outcomes, fewer disparities, improve patient trust, and enhance operational efficiencies. Once the content standards are complete, exchange standards will be developed through the HL7 process. This will ensure we not only have the what, but we also have the where and the how. This information is critical to identifying disparities and determining where there may be bias and in a model using AI so that can be mitigated or eliminated. AHIP supports a risk-based approach to oversight that differentiates between high risk and or high impact and low risk AI. For example, the use of deep neural networks in clinical care presents a more significant risk to patients than deploying simple algorithms to support administrative functions. Flexibility to right-size business practices and mitigation techniques based on risk is necessary to realize the potential of AI while avoiding overly restrictive, infeasible, or misaligned policies that risk stifling innovation. To that end, we believe AI oversight should avoid subjecting all underlying AI technology to mandatory outside review. Many healthcare organizations developing AI tools, particularly those that function as covered entities under HIPAA, are proactively employing their own risk-based approaches and optimizing existing data governance structures. This would, of course, not prevent, in our mind, organizations from voluntarily engaging in outside review, as many do with cybersecurity and other risk management initiatives. As mentioned previously, we fundamentally view the FAVES principles as a framework to establish and maintain trust as well as quality. Trust is the foundation of our members' engagements with patients and consumers. Health insurance providers build and maintain this trust in numerous ways, including by protecting the privacy of patient information and promoting tools and resources to support patients' active engagement in their health journey. Transparency, in our mind, is a key enabler of trust and a critical component to the successful deployment and use of AI. Patient, consumer, caregiver education is critical to helping individuals better understand what AI is and how it might be used. Simply put, as we explore this vast new frontier, we must ensure that patients, caregivers, and consumers are partners in this journey with us. The appropriate use of AI holds great promise for improving healthcare for all Americans. Engaging a diverse set of stakeholders is essential to this success. So we thank you for holding this hearing, and we're really happy to be a part of it. Look forward to the discussion.
Thank you. We are now on to our final panelist. Christopher Longhurst comes to us. He's the Chief Medical Officer and Chief Digital Officer at the University of California, San Diego Health. Welcome, Christopher.
Well, thank you very much. I see a lot of friends and colleagues in the room. I really wish I could be there with you today, but it wasn't in the cards. As suggested, I serve as both the Chief Medical Officer and the Chief Digital Officer, and so I sometimes describe this synergy is being able to see all the problems and challenges in our healthcare delivery organization from the CMO seat, and then helping to innovate new solutions from the seat of the Chief Digital Officer. So from that standpoint, I'm extraordinarily bullish on the opportunity AI presents us. But as many of our speakers today highlighted, we really need to do that carefully and thoughtfully. So if you go to the next slide, I wanted to highlight, first of all, how we support and endorse AI principles at UC San Diego Health. We actually have an AI governance committee that I stood up 5 or 6 years ago. And in our effort to build trust, as was described in the last speaker's comments, we committed ourselves to transparency. We also committed to not taking humans out of the loop in clinical decisions, and a variety of other principles that actually translated very well to the Biden administration's commitments that were released in December. And I was fortunate to be part of a task force that helped develop that, and really feel like the statements, not just about FAVES, but about commitment to transparency and others, were important. Now, one thing that I would point out in the blueprint for AI Bill of Rights that was released earlier in 2023, the administration outlined that testing conditions should mirror as closely as possible the conditions in which AI will be deployed, and that AI-based support should be monitored on an ongoing basis for adverse outcomes rather than a single off-site evaluation. And so a lot of speakers have addressed this today, and I just wanted to reiterate that that local governance and monitoring has been so critical for us. So I'd like to share an example with you rather than talking in the abstract. So if we can move to the next slide. The example I will share is specifically around generative AI. And partly because of some work that was published this time last year out of UC San Diego Health, identifying that AI chatbots could construct high-quality empathetic responses, we partnered with our electronic health record vendor to actually implement this in a workflow that allowed our physicians to access draft messages that they could then edit. And our AI governance committee had a really great discussion before we put this in about our commitment to transparency. And where we landed is that even though a doctor would be editing and sending every single one of these messages, in fact, in the upper right there, you'll see there's only two buttons. One says start with draft. The other says start blank reply. So there's no button that says just send now, right? But despite the fact that every message would be ultimately taking the accountability from a clinician sending the message, we still decided that full transparency with our patients was critical. And so we were actually the only pilot partner that chose to automatically append an addendum to every message. As you can see here, it essentially reads that this message was generated automatically and then reviewed and edited by your clinician. And I'll tell you that there's a lot of discussion about this, not just at UC San Diego, but in our community locally. The vast overwhelming response from our patients was very positive. They appreciated the transparency, and many of them pointed out that they were concerned about messaging their busy doctor because they knew that their time was limited, and that understanding that their busy doctor had an AI co-pilot actually made them feel better. But they also were very happy that it was being reviewed by a human before it was just sent. So that's one example of how we're putting those principles in action of both keeping a human in the loop and transparency. And if you'll move to my final slide, I will point out again that local governance is really what's enabled all of this. And so just recently, our vendor announced last week that they are making available software that's actually open source for local testing and monitoring of these models. And from our perspective, that's absolutely the only way to ensure that the resulting outcomes are fair, appropriate, valid, effective, and safe, as our commitment suggests. And in fact, I'll close with one final example, which is just a couple months ago, we published the second ever impact of an AI algorithm on sepsis mortality. And this is the culmination of work we've been doing for 3 or 4 years in this space. But a couple of things I'll point out. Number one, the algorithm that we developed was actually based on our own data set. And many of our speakers spoke about health equity issues. And I'll tell you that as we reviewed our own data around sepsis, we identified opportunities to close equity gaps. And so really building this with our own data helped us to ensure that we were guiding it in a way that was maximally equitable. The second thing was that while we have a fantastic data scientist who built an amazing multimodal algorithm, we actually credit 20 or 30% of the outcome to the algorithm itself. Because in fact, the majority of the benefit that we accomplished was from workflow redesign. For example, we know and we found that firing alerts to our busy frontline clinicians was not helpful in terms of the interventions that we wanted to implement. And so we actually constructed a workflow where our code team, which is a central team out of the count, received some of these alerts and can help to close those gaps when appropriate. And so we credit a lot of that workflow and process redesign for the outcomes that we achieved. In fact, I'll just close by saying that the editor of the journal where we published this actually wrote an accompanying editorial called Integrating AI into Healthcare Systems, More Than Just the Algorithm. And in that editorial, they described all the considerations for implementing AI in healthcare systems that are really beyond sort of the algorithm itself. And I think that's particularly important, you know, even as last week, the FDA, you know, approved a sepsis AI algorithm that has yet to demonstrate kind of those impacts in a local context. So I'll close there and really look forward to the conversation. And once again, I really appreciate the HITECH committee taking the time to dive deep into these issues. I appreciate all of my colleagues taking the time for this important discussion. And I think this was a great opportunity to dive into these issues. So thank you.
Great. Thank you so much to all. Thank you so much for all of our panelists with all of your expertise, especially about FAVES. FAVES is such an incredibly important set of principles, and especially for those that are actually reviewing all of our various different forms of artificial intelligence and decision support interventions to ensure that it is going to be as safe and as fair, as well as appropriate, valid, effective as possible for all of our patient populations. We are going to open it up for questions already. People have flipped their names, and we have people also in the virtual world. All right, Sarah's going to help me in the very first one. See, we're getting faster. You see what? Everyone knows the drill now. Mark, you are first.
Awesome. So I know there won't be a lot of time for multiple people to chime in, but I'd love to get Dominic, your thoughts on this, and then Ashley and Chris, anything you can share. The problem that most vexes me personally is working in a high resource environment, seeing what it takes to do internal product lifecycle management well. I think Chris and Ashley, you're both giving examples of how to do that. Dominic, you have years of experience supporting community clinics across the state of Georgia with that last mile implementation of technology. So from your vantage point, what should we be thinking about as a federal agency or advisors to a federal agency? What's going to be needed at the last mile? Maybe you're not going to get all the bells and whistles of what Chris and Ashley described, but yeah, what do we have to get out there quickly to enable adoption of FAVES in the settings that you support?
And Dominic, before you answer, I just want to be, we have a lot of questions. And so Dominic, we'll just have you answer this question. But for the other panelists, you please go ahead and put your comments in the chat, because I do want to make sure that we get to all the HITECH members' questions. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mark. The map I showed earlier, the safety nets, very qualified health centers, and we talked about the practices that really don't have the connectivity. And the effective AI, when we use the E out of the FAVES, will be effective because of the data that's obtained. And when you look at these populations that are underserved and the providers who are underserved, if we're not connecting and we're not able to obtain that information and data, we won't be able to access and treat those patients properly with AI. So I do think it's a right fit type implementation for different communities. We've always said high tech is not necessarily better than low tech if it's not right. You know, you look at how they've used mobile phones in Africa, et cetera, to be real effective. So I think to your question, we have to work with those communities. You all brought in one of your publications about the importance of local, you know, being in locally, implementing locally, involving social scientists. I think what I was alluding to on the first slide is the fact that we need these communities involved at all stages of development of AI. That's how we're going to get the best out of AI, and that's how it will be developed for the community. So in summary, the pipeline has to include folks from all communities, you know, across from African American to American Indian and in between and so on, disability, et cetera. We need to have a pipeline of scientists who evolved, but also communities involved as we build these solutions.
Thank you so much for that answer. Next is Rochelle.
I feel like we're on a tag team here, but you answered my question that was directed to Dr. Mack.
I'm so sorry, Rochelle, if you can get a little bit closer to the mic so everyone can hear you.
Okay, my question for Dr. Mack was actually answered by Mark, or under Mark's question. So I will move to the next question for Samantha. Thank you, first of all, for acknowledging that patients, before they come into a health system, are consumers, and they deserve the protection under the as consumers and customers. So my question is, how do we address how patients can engage after they've interacted with the healthcare system and understanding that AI is being used in ways that they had not imagined? If you could talk a bit about that, thank you.
So I think that there are two parts to your question, and I'll be brief knowing that we have a lot to get through. I think the first part is we're going to have to at some point have a serious conversation about roles and responsibilities across the ecosystem. When we talk about when a patient is harmed as a result of AI, who's responsible for that? Right. And it's a difficult conversation. I'm not surprised that it hasn't been at the forefront of what folks want to sit around and talk about. But I think we're going to have to get there, right? Because that is sort of part of what you're asking, right? Because we can put up 1-800 numbers for folks, we can put out flyers, we can make information publicly available, but ultimately, if there's no next step for them and we're just looping them around, right, they're never ultimately going to get to that answer. And more importantly, also the information on what was the sort of foundation of their harm or how their harm came to be, their story's never going to get told. So to me, that's sort of like two parts of the question you asked.
Thank you for the question and for the answer as well. Next, we're going to have Shyla.
Thank you for the presentations. The question I have regards accessibility. Dominic, as you had the map up and you were talking about community providers and different things, I come from a frontier state, and I know, you know, we have a lot of rural health clinics, a lot of critical access hospitals that staff wear many hats and could really benefit off these things. However, they also operate on a tight margin. And so with that being said, how do we make these tools and implement these tools and make them more accessible to some of those organizations that need it the most, that aren't connected to the big six or the major corporations?
I guess Mark's name been called a lot, so he must be popular. But in one of the stat articles that they wrote, they suggested that we have these, just like we had the 62 regional extension centers, that I guess from the federal perspective, we put funds into support for these communities. Now, as I outlined in my slides, I think we do need to do it differently. I think we did a great job. We were part of that effort, but also we've learned from that. We need to make sure it's sustainable. I think some of that is providing sustainable funding to these communities, understanding that the safety net, in some instances, independent organizations really don't have the resources to sustain this technology and support it. But we can support other things across this country. We can surely support this. So I think we just have to look at a new effort really from the federal perspective to put funds in the hands of these communities, but make sure it's, you know, it's sustainable. But I think that model is one we can think about.
Thank you. Next, we'll go to Michael on Zoom.
Yeah, thank you. Really great talks. I had questions specifically about either Ashley or Chris's talks. you talked about, you know, Ashley described AI governance structures within NYP, and Chris, you mentioned you know, how local governance enables clinical impact at UCSD. And I'm just would love your thoughts about to what extent governance should be within an institution. You know, because some of these questions you mentioned for governance, you know, things like some whether something is safe or effective, seem like they should just be part of the regulatory process for everybody, you know, FDA or some other government body. And I'm curious, you know, if you feel like some of it is being, you're doing it locally because we don't have that, you know, large guidance yet. And I would just love your thoughts about what part you feel like is going to need to remain locally and where do we draw the line about what should be, you know, general regulatory stuff, you know, versus local. So, you know, thank you.
I think that's a great question and something that we think about and we partner with our regulatory team because we know this is an evolving landscape. Things are changing. A lot of the federal organizations are observing to understand, you know, how should we regulate this space? And so I look at the local governance as also a way to implement the standards that are developing. And as regulation evolves, it would be a mechanism to make sure that we're aligned with that regulation. But there are also things that need to be regulated locally, like some of that monitoring and surveillance and the implementation of these best practices, as well as the concept of, you know, Chris mentioned the workflow was a large portion of the effectiveness of the sepsis model. Those are things that need to be done at a local level because they're going to vary across institutions.
Yeah, I'll just add on to Dr. Beachy's comments that she's exactly right. I mean, the outcomes that we achieve are so dependent on local context that I really don't think that this is something where, you know, a regulatory body sort of a central level can help to make this happen. You know, just as an example, there have been thousands of publications about sepsis and AI, and only a very small percentage of those have been evaluated. And even a smaller percentage of those have had impact on outcomes. And so I really worry, you know, when we're sort of providing kind of a national stamp of approval on algorithms and saying that, you know, we know that they pass sort of muster with, let's say, a standardized data set, that does not translate to efficacy in many or most cases. And so I think that there is no instance in which there should not also be local governance in addition to whatever needs to happen sort of at a national level. And I know that, you know, this raises some concerns about resources and, you know, things of that nature. I put a comment in the chat about shared instances of electronic health records. A great example is federally qualified health centers. So in San Diego County, uniquely, one in three of our residents gets primary care from an FQHC. Many of those FQHCs now get their electronic health record from a vendor called Ochin that provides the instance of an EHR to FQHCs in 36 states. And so while the local FQHCs don't have the resources to kind of, you know, construct the AI governance committees, OCHIN certainly does and can represent a lot of these practices really effectively. And so I think there's ways we can look at making this happen, but I do not see that removing local kind of accountability and oversight makes any sense.
Excellent. Thank you so much for those remarks. Next is Anna.
Going to follow the rules again, Anna McAllister. Doesn't happen often. My question is for Samantha, and I have to admit, I mean, coming to this as somebody who's, again, the primary hat that I wear on high tech is as of a patient. You know, I've got complex type 1 diabetes, lots of complications. I take lots of medications, 20 currently. I have 16 different doctors. Those diabolic, I don't know if you heard my comments earlier, but like I mentioned used the word diabolical within the context of the use of EHR-derived data-informed AI and implications. Most of those case studies that I've seen and have surfaced all relate to access and the use of algorithms by health insurance companies to come up with mechanisms of restricting care and or making accessing care so incredibly burdensome on individuals that it essentially makes it impossible to access, and you know, creating obstructions. And that is one of my truly biggest concerns. And everything you said is wonderful. Transparency, you know, putting patients first, all of that stuff is great. Love it. How is that actually being operationalized amongst healthcare, amongst health insurance companies? And has the industry established any kind of standards and accountability for its members to actually live up to that? Because I'm really convinced that, and I would love to be convinced otherwise, that these tools aren't going to be a way of putting sort of draconian decisions behind a black box, calling it AI and making it completely impossible to understand why the decisions are being made that are being made.
So I can speak a little bit to process. I think like any membership organization, I can't speak to any one member's particular practices, although we do have now several governance committees around AI that we're creating specifically to have those conversations. And so what we are doing at AHIP is we are in the process of developing a set of principles on AI, and then looking at potential next steps for that in terms of the industry. But there is a ton of receptivity. And I'm looking over at Katrina because she has been involved in this process longer than I have as a new staff person at AHIP. But I think that it is being taken very seriously. And what we're trying to do is dig down into experience versus reality of how algorithms are being used by plans. I think prior authorization, and that's a scary term, that, but I think that's one of the main use cases that comes up is prior authorization. And when we speak to members, we hear that prior authorization, AI and prior auth is only used for approvals, not for denials, and also for documentation. So again, anecdotal, but we do have a process that we are undertaking to create principles in that space.
Thank you, Samantha. Bryant?
Thanks, Dr. Reese and Dr. Longhurst. Wanted to call out a conversation we've been having in the chat and thinking about, Chris, you kind of touched on it, low resource settings and opportunities to pull in partnerships and representation for those FQHCs, but what about the even lower resourced partners in this healthcare space, public health agencies, public health authorities? AI is impacting our world and our decision-making, and I'm wondering, is there a opportunity, or could you talk to how do public health partners, do they need to become a seat at the table in the governance in the clinical space, or do we need our own local governance of how these AI tools are impacting public health? And Bryant Karras, Washington State.
Dr. Karras, great to see you again. And Bryant and I got to know each other through the pandemic and some work our states were collaborating on around exposure notification. And I'd actually point to that as a really outstanding model for two or three reasons. Number one is that there was state-based kind of leadership that enabled local work. And so I certainly think that there's a role for the state, public health agencies to help take the lead in this. Number two is that both California and Washington were partnered closely with academic institutions who helped to monitor outcomes and ensure, you know, equity and fairness. And I think those type of partnerships in the public health space can be really effective. I can speak, you know, locally here. Our School of Public Health is very interested in partnering with our, you know, county and state and other public health authorities around the use of AI in particular. And so I think you'll find ready and willing resources to partner. With respect to kind of where it's actually done, I think part of that really depends on the workflows and the systems being used. And ultimately, the institutions that are running those systems that bear the brunt of the daily workflow are where the home should be, because we've learned if you don't workflow integrate these decision support tools, they're not going to make a difference. We can predict all sorts of things with machine learning and AI, but if it doesn't get predicted at a point in time where there's a pivotal moment and a decision's being made, it's not going to actually have the impact on outcomes that matters to our patients and the families we serve.
Thank you for the question, Brian. Thank you for that answer, Chris. And especially, Brian, of emphasizing the importance that of ensuring that public health and our clinical settings are always in lock and step. And also, of course, when it comes to both our local, our state, as well as federal governments, we have to do it all together. So I think I see Ike's hand is also up on Zoom. So Ike, you have the floor.
Great, thank you. Kind of building on what Dr. Karas was talking about, do you have some recommendations about how we might approach a consensus-based approach or a collaborative-based approach that brings together clinicians, academic researchers, HIT developers, public health, and patients to collaboratively develop a framework, both on the regulatory side and a data governance environment that helps foster the development of AI that is useful across domains and between domains, that we're using the same basic tool set between public health, healthcare, and other environments?
And Ike, was that a question for a particular panelist?
No, I'll let any of the panelists who care to take
Excellent. Anyone would like to answer that question?
I mean, I can just say, I think that is happening to some extent in these national collaborations. They're bringing together, you know, various stakeholders to really think about this broadly. And I would recommend taking a look at the work that they're doing. I can put some of the names in the chat if that's helpful, if you want to refer to those groups.
Absolutely. And thinking particularly, you know, with additional attention looking at the patient groups, because a lot of those, particularly the rare disease organizations, don't necessarily have a big national presence or aren't necessarily on the national radar or organizational radar in that sense, but collectively are still a substantial population.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Ike. And thank you so much for the response. Well, I think we have actually gone through all of our questions. Are there any other questions from HITECH? All right, we see one more question. Okay, you all, we have 6 minutes, and especially you, the two of you all, yes. So to the ONC staff, we are no longer going to have these two sit next to each other coming forward. We truly only have time for one more question. And so, Rochelle, we'll end on this question. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Hopefully this will help to address my partner in crime over here. Dr. Mack, this question is for you. Considering before the implementation and use of generative AI, the Institution of Public Health was a widely adopted component to healthcare and healthcare practice and interaction. Within the closing of healthcare systems that partner with these public health systems, how are we addressing the equitable use of AI within public health? And it's an add-on to Dr. Bryant Thomas Karras's question. All three names.
that's a loaded question. When I think of public health, I don't think of departments, public health departments. Public health is not owned by any one department, academic institution, et cetera. But public health departments within the states are important in implementing technology. And there's a difference across the country. We saw that with COVID. When it came to, you know, just the distribution of logistics of vaccinations and other things, not to get into that, but I think it varies from state to state. Dr. Longhurst just named some things that was happening out in California, particularly Southeast and Georgia, you know, when it comes to the population that we focus on. Underserved, some people don't want to use underserved, but The underserved population, you know, states approach that population differently with resources and engagement with innovative tools. So I would answer that by almost not answering it, but it varies from state to state. It varies in different areas. But I think the previous question, public health has to be involved in the conversation. And I go back to the what I stated earlier, at all stages, and make sure that we're not only representing the patient, but we're representing the various communities. And let me just say this, and I'll end with this. Poverty is associated with health, with education and health. We know if you're poor, if you're non-educated, you're gonna be unhealthy. Poverty has grown. We have more children in poverty now than we did in 1950. So AI has to be coupled with other interventions that we have across this country.
And that is an excellent way to end this hearing of really focusing on ensuring that we're centering healthcare, public health, the social drivers of health, and all of these other elements as we're thinking about applying the FADES principle to the design, development, deployment, and post-market evaluation of artificial intelligence. So on that note, I want to thank all of our amazing panelists for being here, and especially the two of you also here in person, for lending all of your expertise from across the country. And we want to just thank you for being part of this important panel as well as this important hearing. Great. And so at this moment, I know everyone's worthy of a hand clap. At this moment, I'm going to actually transition to Wendy in order for us to proceed to public comment.
Thank you, Madel. Okay, we'd like to open the meeting now for public comment. If you're on Zoom and you'd like to make a comment, please use the hand raise function at the bottom of the Zoom toolbar. If you're on the phone only, please press *9 to raise your hand. And once called upon, press *6 to mute and unmute your line. We'll pause for a moment to see if any members of the public would like to make a comment. And just a reminder, our next HITAC meeting will be on May 16th, and all the materials from today's meeting are available on healthit.gov. Okay, at this time, there does not appear to be any public comments, so I will yield the time back to our co-chairs. Madel and Sarah, please proceed.
I believe it's my honor to do the first send-off. I want to thank all of you for joining us today, both in person and on Zoom. It's a pleasure to work with all of you on HITAC toward this critical mission of informing policy. I also want to thank all the panelists who came to present critical topics in artificial intelligence and our responsibility to do it justly. We were all better for your voices and wisdom, and we hope you can come back in future meetings. And I also want to thank my amazing co-chair. Madel, thank you. And thank you to the ONC team for supporting this in-person event and for supporting our work.
Well, thank you so much, Sarah. And I too want to echo Sarah's comments of saying thank you all for just an amazing day. I want to first acknowledge Mickey and Elise for allowing us to even have this hearing. It started off as just an idea, and definitely through your leadership, Elise, and support also of Mickey and his leadership, we were able to do this, and especially bring experts from across the country, as well as the voices of those that have not really been here for us to hear. So I appreciate your leadership and your support of that. I also want to thank Mark for helping us to also organize this hearing along with my wonderful co-chair, Sarah. And so really appreciate all your insight. And again, to all of the panelists, as Sarah said, we are so much better for your voice and for your expertise. Thank you for your preparation and taking the time. To the amazing HITAC committee, there is never a dull moment with this committee. And
really all of your brilliance that always shines through every single time that we are able to get together. And especially as we're continuing to drive, thinking about policies and standards and whatever we can do to help to support ONC and the rest of our federal agencies. And always a round of applause and appreciation for the ONC staff and the Excel staff. We can never do any of this without you all. And so on those notes, again, I'm looking forward to our next high tech meeting, and thank you all, and safe travels home as you proceed home as well. Wendy?
Ooh, the final word. Well, thank you again, everyone, on behalf of ONC. We are so, so privileged to have you with us. It has been really enlightening. Get home safely. And if you can give me your name tags, that would be great. In the spirit of sustainability. We will see you again soon. Thank you, everyone, and have a great day.